Good morning, and thank you for joining us on this kind of rainy, dreary day. But we have a topic that I hope won't be rainy or dreary to discuss with you today. I'm Diane Rowland, the Executive Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and we're pleased to be sponsoring this workshop today on Medicare private fee-for-service plans, looking at the implications for both beneficiaries and the overall Medicare program. And we have a great panel to be with us today to really share some of their views and experience with both analyzing and implementing these plans. For those of you who are new to the game and those of you who have been with it for a long time, we have been seeing the development of managed care plans and HMOs as a part of the Medicare benefit since the 1970s. But we really saw some advancement of that option with the Balanced Budget Act of 1997 that put in some new plan options for preferred provider organizations, provider-sponsored organizations, private fee-for-service plans, high deductible plans with MSAs, just so that we could get a lot of new initials into the Medicare program. With the Medicare Modernization Act, the MMA of 2003, we also saw some new initials added, special needs plans or SNPs, and regional PPOs. But what we've also seen over that time, as this slide reflects, is that the enrollment has fluctuated in these private health plans under Medicare, but that now at the 2007 point, we are at about 8.3 million Medicare beneficiaries enrolled in these private health plans. That represents a little under 19% of the overall Medicare population. Also, maybe it's because I spend some time looking at Medicaid, which varies by state. I think one can see from this slide that the penetration of these private plans really does vary as well across the country, the yellow states being those with the highest concentration. If you look at the state averages, it averages about 15.6% in the states. But as I said, if you take the overall national numbers because of the higher concentration in big states like California, about 18.8% of Medicare beneficiaries are now enrolled in these plans. If we look at the distribution of the plans for the 8.3 million people in them now, you see that the major source is still 74% are in HMOs, PPOs, and PSOs, but the private fee-for-service plans now constitute about 16% of the enrollment in the private plans, which is why today we're taking a special look at them. These private fee-for-service plans, as you'll undoubtedly, hopefully, learn more about in the course of this discussion, were first authorized, as I said, under the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, but the first plan was not offered until 2000. These plans typically do not have provider networks. The enrollees can access any provider willing to accept the plan's payment. They're required to offer Part A and B benefits, and they may offer enhanced benefits or reduced cost sharing. They're not required to offer Part D benefit, but about half do. And they're exempt from some of the requirements that apply to other Advantage plans, specifically quality and utilization review management practices. And in them, in their implementation now, virtually all beneficiaries have access to one or more of these plans. And this slide just really shows you and reflects the tremendous growth, especially since 2000, but looking from 2005 to 2007 in the enrollment in these plans. And you see there the share that now offer the Part D drug benefit as well as Part A and B benefits. So today we're really going to focus on what these plans are, how they're operating, and what some of the challenges and issues are. And we have with us Jonathan Blum, the Vice President for Medicaid and Long-Term Care at Avalir Health, but an individual who has also spent an extensive part of his career working on Medicare issues as well. Joyce Dubow, the Senior Advisor for Policy and Strategy at AARP. Marcia Gold, a Senior Fellow for Mathematica Policy Research, who has done much of our work trying to track the development of private plans under the Medicare option. Mark Miller, the Executive Director of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, and Catherine Schmidt from the Vice President of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, and Gary Jacobs, the Senior Vice President of Universal American Financial Corporation, both of whom operate and work with the private fee-for-service plans. So I'd like to start our discussion and get some views from John, who's done one of the papers that's in your package on private fee-for-service plans and how they operate, to just really give us a quick description beyond the few words I offered on what these plans are, how they operate, and how they came to be a part of the Medicare plan.
Thanks very much for having us today. I also want to acknowledge Ruth Brown, who's sitting in the third row, who helped put this paper together for us. I think I'll first talk about the history of private fee-for-service plans, and I think it has a very unique history that Congress added this benefit or this plan choice option to the program back in 1997, I think, for three primary reasons. One is to try and foster more plan development throughout the country and to ensure that all areas of the country, for example, rural areas, had access to a private plan choice. And I think that what really distinguishes a private fee-for-service plan from a traditional HMO plan is they don't have to offer a healthcare network. They don't have to have a kind of similar network that an HMO has to have in order to give beneficiaries a kind of full choice of services, providers, hospitals, what have you. The kind of second reason I think this plan option came to about was to give beneficiaries a kind of full range of plan choices, from a more tightly managed HMO option, for example, to a more open network type plan, private fee for service. And these are plans that are set up to provide a benefit package very similar to the traditional fee-for-service program, but in a capitated private plan payment type arrangement. These plans can offer lower cost share, and they can offer lower premiums than was offered to the traditional fee-for-service beneficiaries. But I think this plan choice was created to give beneficiaries the full kind of panoply of private plan options. And I think, surprising to some, the third reason that this plan option was created was that Congress heard a lot of concerns from the right-to-life interests that were concerned that as Medicare was trying to expand private plan options, that a more restrictive plan choice would be pushed onto beneficiaries. And so these interests really wanted to see a kind of plan option that would preserve beneficiaries' right to have care, to extend life, for example. So this is not just about a kind of market type arrangement, but Congress also heard other concerns concerns about trying to extend life, for example, from the right to life interest, which is one of the reasons that Congress created this plan option back in 1997.
And Marcia, what have we been seeing in terms of which firms are moving into this market, and have they been in the Advantage market for a while, or are they really new entities?
Well, you know, one of the things I think you need to recognize, one of the things you need to recognize when you look at this is that the MA market has always been fairly concentrated. That is, while there's a lot of players, a couple of firms really drive a lot of the market. Although in individual markets, you have places like Harvard Pilgrim, some of the Blues plans, things like that, that are quite active. The first fee-for-service plan was Sterling. It was very new to the market. That hadn't been an MA before. It was a Medigap and other type of insurer. But it actually never got much traction. And while it's expanded and reduced its service area over time, the enrollment has never gotten that big. The private fee-for-service option really started to take off when some of the existing players in MA, Humana, United Healthcare, got involved around 2003, 2004. And then after the MA was enacted, the firms began to expand their presence. Humana was very aggressive, but you saw more people coming in. There were around 12 firms in 2006. But consistent with the way the regular MA program works, the enrollment's still pretty concentrated. Humana had, this is at the end of 2006, around November, Humana had 57% of all MA enrollment, and United Healthcare had another 22%. WellPoint had 9%. So 89% of the enrollees were in three firms, and Humana was accounting for more than half of that. Now, in 2007, we see a more dramatic expansion of the number of firms at offering products. And in the paper that I did, those are listed. And you can see who was in 2006 and 2007 and how many counties they cover. Universal, you know, some of the plans that were in there before expanded broadly. Universal American, who in the paper is called Heritage because they're associated with them, was particularly aggressive. The WellPoint and Sterling also expanded. We saw Coventry and Sierra enter the market in an aggressive way, but there were around 30 firms that had some involvement. Now, when you look at them, I think most of them have some Medicare Advantage experience. They either operated an HMO or they bought an HMO, but they were pretty limited. To a large extent, a lot of the new firms coming in, I think, were very active in the Medigap business and were using their own agents to sell them, so the costs of doing that were there. And if you can sort of speculate on what was going on, what you saw is that in 2006, a lot of the Medigap insurers started to offer some prescription drug plans. And then I think in 2007, they expanded out into private fee-for-service. My speculation is that it's a way both to attract the new market, because Medicare modernization opened that up, but also to hedge the bets in the Medicap market, because no one's sure which way the enrollment's going to go, so that firms are positioned to make those changes, and also to deal with the retiree group business, which is shrinking and changing its form, so firms are set up so they can do it. One of the results of this is that there's now half of all beneficiaries have a private fee-for-service plan available from six or more firms. So they have six or more firms. There's more plans they have to choose from. And most of the rest have three to five private fee-for-service options available. And as Diane mentioned, the private fee-for-service option doesn't have to offer an MA product with Part D coverage. In 2006, most did, but some, like Pacific Care, and I think maybe Universal American, did not have a drug benefit. In 2007, the company seemed to be offering both the MA-only and MAPD options, although some stick with just offering MA, and then they often have a private fee-for-service on the side so people can bundle it. Hope that wasn't too long an answer to your questions, Diane.
Well, you noted the retiree issues there, and Kathy, your plan covers more than 100,000 retirees. Can you sort of explain why this option may be appealing for those employers with retirees and how that works?
Certainly. We're Michigan Blue Cross Blue Shield. In our state, we obviously have a preponderance of employer groups, particularly from the old legacy industries, the autos, the steels, et cetera. And these groups obviously are looking for ways to lower the cost for both themselves and their members, as well as to have an opportunity to increase quality for the Medicare beneficiaries. And the reason that this kind of program, the private fee-for-service, works so uniquely is the way the CMS rules work and what is and is not allowable. First off, you have groups that frequently have defined benefits through either a union contract or some other kind of agreement. And these groups are generally trying to have the same benefit for their active employees, their non-Medicare retirees, and their Medicare-eligible retirees. So it's a product where they have the option of being able to start with the Medicare benefits and then try and then be able to build on top of it the additional benefits, so that across their entire spectrum of members, they basically have the same benefit package. The other thing that private fee-for-service allows is that it is the only MA product where, regardless of where a member is retired, you can enroll the member. So for almost any of the retiree groups, even if they're only located in Michigan, they still have people who have retired throughout the country. The largest group that we just enrolled beginning in January of this year is what is the private or the public school retirees. And people think of it frequently as teachers, but it also includes the maintenance workers, the bus drivers, the cafeteria workers. So although we refer to it as teachers, there's also a lot of people who are retirees that are lower income. And so these folks, once they retire, they're all over the country. there's about 18% of this 100,000 group that are retired in other states, which is in addition to the snowbirds. And so the group does not have to worry about trying to patch together a whole group of HMOs or PPOs, which they really could not even do and hit every zip code, no matter where the person retires. So it's an ideal option for them to be able to implement a single program that they can now make this a replacement product rather than just an option that covers perhaps 30 or 40 or 60% of their beneficiaries. The other thing is, it does result in significant member acceptance. If you remember, you know, when groups are trying to make a change like this, they have political pressures, and so they're looking to have a product where they can make it look as much as possible like the program that they have today and have minimal disruption for their members. So it's a product that we've been able to implement for the MPSRs, which is the Michigan Public School Retirees, again, in a way that it has had minimal disruption. And we have also been able to work very closely with providers by anticipating where members are retired to and to be able to do appropriate outreach to those providers so that they have an opportunity, so we have an opportunity to educate them in advance of what Medicare Advantage is, what private fee for services, so that we can avoid disruption for the members. There is the care management piece is one of probably the most significant things that the employer is interested in. They do not believe it's possible to have a replacement product, and certainly the rules don't allow it for HMO, PPO, as well as the disruption factor. But they are able to bring in a private fee-for-service plan and then be able to get introduce the care management features for this group in the form of either care management, disease management, complex case management, nurse helplines, predetermination, and these kind of voluntary programs, and to be able to get their members the kind of services that they're looking for. The other thing is the flexibility is what the employer likes from the standpoint that they can start out and say, we want to start with a Medicare Advantage, but we want to take the subsidy on the drugs. Or we're going to start with the PDP, which is what the public school did. They first went to the PDP, and now they're adding the MAPD so that we're able to coordinate the care across both the medical benefits as well as the prescription benefits. Or another group can come in and say, we want to maintain another drug company. So it allows a great deal more flexibility. And many of them, particularly municipalities, are concerned about the alternatives. You know, they basically have four. They can increase the cost to the member, they can cut the benefits, they can reduce other programs, or they can simply exit from the employer market. Now, the municipalities don't have that kind of option, but certainly the commercials do. And then lastly, of course, is the significant concern over the GASB requirements for the municipalities and what those issues mean to them. So the bottom line is the private fee for service is the one that provides the flexibility for employers that they can actually implement a program on a national basis rather quickly, although it does take a significant investment on their part to be able to do that.
Well, Joyce, that's an employer perspective. From the ARP standpoint, what are the key issues for beneficiaries here?
Well, I would like to talk about it from the beneficiary perspective. I appreciate the flexibility that employers have, but from the general Medicare beneficiary who may or may not be getting benefits through an employer, I think we certainly support choice. Nobody suggests that the traditional Medicare is the appropriate option for every beneficiary, which is why meaningful choice is important. I think the question around choice, though, has to be considered again when we see the proliferation of choice and what the choices are. Genuine choice is important. Confused choice is confusing. I think that when we consider what the private fee-for-service option is, there is the opportunity for confusion at the get-go. It looks very, very much like the traditional program, but it's not. It's run by a private plan. It's a risk-based program. The question is whether Medicare beneficiaries understand what this choice is, considering the fact that there's no analog in the private sector. This is a statutory creation. There's nothing to which a beneficiary can attach any kind of experiential understanding. It's a new concept. It's very strange. So what do we know about what beneficiaries understand? Right after BBA, we did a baseline assessment of beneficiary knowledge of their choices when the Medicare program was relatively unconfusing, not confusing. It only had essentially HMOs and a handful of PPOs that were around. And when we assessed the understanding between HMOs and the traditional program, we found knowledge and an understanding of how these programs work and how they differed extremely low. Judy Hibbert did this study for us. The assessment was about 11% of people had what we considered adequate knowledge to understand how to navigate and understand the programs. We did a second study more recently following the MMA, and knowledge levels continue to be low, but the program is that much more complex. So Medicare beneficiaries have a real challenge. We are lacking really good research data that tells us what we hear anecdotally a lot, and that is that people sign on with these plans who don't get what they thought they were getting. People who feel that they didn't know what they were enrolling in and then want out. There are the stories that we hear about marketing practices, the stories we hear that a strategy of the plans is to let beneficiaries get their feet wet so that they may move from a private fee-for-service plan to another MA product. That sounds like bait and switch. That's not what beneficiaries are understanding. So we have the issue around confusion. Not to say that we also hear stories about how physicians are confused about what this option means. We also have concerns about what private fee-for-service means for the beneficiary as a beneficiary of the large Medicare program. And I assume you're going to have Mark talk about some of those issues. But I will say at this point that we have been in agreement with the MedPAC recommendations around payment, that Medicare should not be driving enrollment with its payment approach, that choices for Medicare beneficiaries ought to be neutral from the perspective of the Medicare program.
Well, I was going to note that many of those who get retiree health benefits are also among the Medicare beneficiaries that tend to be of higher income than others, and so that does raise some real equity issues. And Mark, I wondered if you would weigh in on some of the look at between traditional Medicare and these plans. Are there issues regarding equity, level of payment?
Right, and I think my comments are you know, more broad than just on private fee-for-service. We made these recommendations the last couple of years, and so I think that's more the perspective. And I also want to say, just before I go through some of this, because it kind of gets lost in the debate from time to time, we make recommendations for all providers in Medicare. We're not just making recommendations about managed care. We also make recommendations for hospitals and other providers. You know, we have a perspective when we make these recommendations in trying to focus on what Medicare should be paying for the efficient provider, assuring that the beneficiary gets access to services, and assuring that the providers get paid fairly. There's a couple of perspectives that I think are important to understand the information that we have put out. When we do the analysis, we're taking the perspective from a program perspective. Are we paying? Who pays for the program? Is there equity in that payment? A second perspective I would sort of point, and I'll get to that in just a second, but a second perspective in setting this up is, I think some of the original thought behind the managed care program was the managed care programs, through networks, through care coordination, through utilization review, that type of thing, through negotiation with providers, would be more efficient than fee-for-service, would generate those efficiencies, would in turn allow them to offer additional benefits to beneficiaries and then attract beneficiaries into the plan. And it feels like the situation has changed. You know, the commission has long supported managed care plans, but from the perspective, as Joyce has kind of taken my whole thing here, so I'm trying to build it up a little bit before I get, but
I didn't touch the numbers.
No, I got it. But the point that she made and that I'm driving at here is that the payment should be neutral. It should be a neutral stance relative to the beneficiary's choice. We should be paying the same for a beneficiary who chooses fee-for-service as a beneficiary who chooses managed care. I'm not going to go through all of the detail, and I suspect there are a lot of people in the room who understand it, but as a result of the administratively set benchmarks that were set under different versions of managed care and the current bidding process, we end up with very high, and where enrollment has gone in the country, and in some instances towards, more recently, towards the private fee-for-service plans, we end up with payments that on average across the country are 112% of fee-for-service. And the commission sees that as an issue. And so that's what's led the commission to a recommendation that says we should be paying at 100% of fee-for-service. And of course, that raises issues about how the plans can continue to operate with these kinds of benefit packages. It's also, I think, important to point out that the first thing I'm setting up is that you have this 112% relative to fee-for-service, and we've made this recommendation that it should be 100% of fee-for-service, recognizing that there are beneficiaries enrolled in these plans and that getting to that may require some transition. But it also, given some of the enrollment trends, for example, those enrollment trends towards private fee-for-service, which have very high payment rates, it makes the situation untenable and makes it urgent that we address this issue now. The other point I would make, or a couple other points, and I won't go on too much longer, are if you look across the various plan options, HMOs versus private fee-for-service and, you know, the regional PPOs, the amount that on average the program pays above fee-for-service differs. So, for example, for HMOs, we pay about 110% of fee-for-service. But for private fee-for-service plans, we pay 119%. And again, this is the distribution of the enrollment across the country in counties that have very high payment rates, which I can explain on question, but it's a bit complicated for a quick run through things. We have also made recommendations that are based on a principle of saying we should pay fairly and equitably across plan types. So, for example, we made a recommendation to eliminate the PPO development fund or stabilization fund, I guess is the proper title, because we felt that gave certain plans certain advantages. There were some comments made early on in the setup that, for example, private fee-for-service plans are not under the same requirements. They don't have the same network requirements. They don't have the same quality reporting requirements. And those types of things can also give plans different advantages. The very last thing I'll say is that there is, in fact, evidence that HMO or that the managed care plans can provide benefits below fee-for-service or can provide can be more efficient than fee-for-service. If you look at the data, and again, it's a little bit complicated, but if you look at their bid on a standard AB benefit for an average beneficiary, and I realize that's complicated, but basically what a plan says it costs them to provide the traditional Medicare benefits, you find that on average, HMOs can provide that benefit for less than fee-for-service, a few points less, about 3 points less than fee-for-service. But at the other extreme, for example, private fee-for-service plans actually provide that benefit at 109% of fee-for-service. And another way to think about the Commission's work in this area and position in this area is that our point is we should be trying to drive the system towards the efficiencies that can be realized by the managed care plans, and then through those efficiencies, additional benefits can be provided to beneficiaries. That's a quick run through things, but we could go on, I'm sure.
Well, thanks, Mark. Well, Marcia, in terms of extra benefits for the private fee-for-service plans compared to Medicare HMOs, I know your research has looked at some of that. Can you
Yeah.
With your mic on.
Sorry.
Mine off.
We'll get us organized. Yeah, we have looked at that, and actually there's a paper on the AARP Public Policy Institute website that looks at the 2006 benefits. I think as Mark alluded to or said, you know, 75% of any savings beyond what the, you know, what plans can use the savings that they have for AB benefits compared to what they get paid to offer extra benefits. And I think you've gotten a sense. I was going to bring up, I think that the figure 4.1 in the MedPAC report is really valuable in looking at how much savings vis-a-vis how it relates to fee-for-service. And Mark mentioned those, so I won't do it. But basically, the point, I think, is that HMOs give you more benefit compared to the private fee-for-service because in the private fee-for-service, the government's paying a lot more to get extra benefits, so there aren't as many benefits around to be given with the savings. And in our own analysis, what we found is that the private fee-for-service plans manage to keep premiums low, and so that's attractive for beneficiaries, but they fill in much less of the cost-sharing compared to HMOs, even though all of them are filling in less than they used to in the past. Medicare, one of the big problems is there's no out-of-pocket limits. And while 70% of the private fee-for-service plans provide an out-of-pocket limit, most of them set a limit at over $25,000 a year. So the private fee-for-service plan gives beneficiaries who might not be able to afford a Medigap policy a less affordable set of a more affordable supplement, but they're getting much less than they would get in a Medigap policy. And I think, with, as Joyce was saying, one of the issues is whether beneficiaries understand that. The other thing, you know, when we looked at it, if we estimate out-of-pocket costs for a beneficiary in good health versus poor health, you end up, if you're in poor health, you could end up paying almost $25,000 a year in a private fee-for-service plan for your Part A, B cost sharing, and whereas it would only be $1,700 in an HMO. One of the things that concerns me is the way the benefits are structured, because they focus on out-of-pocket costs, and there's more of that in private fee-for-service, is that essentially the private fee-for-service is a much better deal for the healthy beneficiary. If you're healthy, if you're in good health, you don't use that much care, your out-of-pocket costs for hospital and physician services are just about equal in an HMO or private fee-for-service plan. And if beneficiaries did understand that, there's a greater incentive for them to join the private fee-for-service plan, more so than sick beneficiaries who would be better served either in an HMO or a Medigap policy. And so it worries me that that could result in a sicker pool of beneficiaries in the traditional Medicare program if that enrollment grows. And when we talked about the private fee-for-service option with plans, it looks like the Medigap, it's both, some of them are trying to attract Medigaps, so you have low premiums, and others are trying to attract some of them are trying to attract Medigap, and so they can have higher premiums, but they have better benefits. The others are trying to attract the HMO-type person, so they have lower premiums, less good benefits. And when you mush it all together in the figures, those get jumbled. So we don't really know. I think if we could ideally separate out where plans are positioning these products, we might have a better sense of what they look like.
Maybe let's turn to Gary and ask Gary why your firm elected to launch into the private fee-for-service market, and do you really see this as a substitute for Medigap? What kinds of individuals are you trying to tailor your marketing to?
Thank you, Diane. And it's kind of interesting being the last one to get a chance to speak, because I know we all have a lot to say. But I think the thing that I can bring to this discussion is the reality of what's happening in cities and counties across America. And the debate in Washington went set against the tone of healthcare in rural Wisconsin or rural Montana is a very different reality. And I'm here to talk about that reality. We're a company that is based in the senior market. It's all we do. We get up every day and think about senior products, senior healthcare, how we can do better at providing those services. We provide a whole host of services, Diane, and they range from Medigap, MedSup. We have 250,000 beneficiaries across every state in this country, to 500,000 people in prescription drug plans all across this country, to 40,000 people in traditional Medicare Advantage plans in multiple markets around this country, and of recent, 150,000 people in private fee-for-service plans. And our thinking is that this is all about choices to beneficiaries. Medicare modernization was kind of the crescendo that from 1997 BBA through 2000 to 2003 institutionalized this idea of bringing products and health plans and services and Medicare Advantage type programs to every county in this country. We all that are in this business, or all of us that are thinking about beneficiary choices, looked at that and said, okay, where do you go? How do you do this? And very strategically, a lot of people kind of looked into their crystal ball and said, the bottom line is options and choices for bennies. When I hear about $25,000 out of pocket in fee-for-service, I don't know about that, because really I know about...
$2,500
is the number. Okay, I think you said $25,000. But $2,500 and $3,000 is the out-of-pocket max in most of the plans around the country. Most of the plans are offering benefits that are very, very unique compared to what traditional Medicare does offer today. Preventive services for prostate screening, cervical screening, for things that people really don't focus on in traditional Medicare. But to me, what has been probably the most important part of private fee-for-service is the integration of care management as a strategy to, on a voluntary basis, to offer members and offer beneficiaries somebody to help them coordinate their services. Because I can tell you, across this great country of ours, that is not being done in Medicare today. And care coordination is not just a word, Diane. It's a reality of having nurses available both on the telephone and nurses in the communities where these people live. And to coordinate a whole host of services that when an 85-year-old beneficiary looks and says, I don't know, my doctor told me this, I think I just do what my doctor told me. Well, we discovered in our second year of a program with only 18,500 people that in one of our months we had almost 50,000 drug interactions that we caught, that if we didn't catch, people would have been taking drugs that would have been counterintuitive to the drug they were offered because they were going to different doctors. So private fee-for-service and fee-for-service are two very different things. Private fee-for-service is an enhancement over fee-for-service, and it's the introduction of bringing managed care principles to a much wider audience. And I'll tell you something. The response has been not only amazing in terms of numbers of enrolled people, but it's been amazing in terms of people's acceptance of these voluntary programs and their compliance with them.
Joyce.
Well, Gary, just to follow up on your point about bringing managed care principles to a new model, the private fee-for-service model, the statute doesn't require that. We're talking about policy. The statute...
The statute might not require it, but we're doing it.
I'm talking about what private fee-for-service organizations are organized and statutorily authorized to do. And what the statute does is essentially to provide a favored treatment, both vis-a-vis the traditional program and vis-a-vis the other Medicare Advantage plans. The rules are much less stringent and oftentimes absent vis-a-vis the private fee-for-service plan. Diane enumerated some of them. The private fee-for-service plans are not required to have the quality improvement processes and programs that the Medicare Advantage programs are. Even traditional Medicare is working under more more oversight than the private fee-for-service are with respect to health care, with performance. This is a statutorily allowed lowering of requirements and restrictions. It's perfectly feasible for anybody to provide services if they will, but we don't have a lot of evidence that that care is easily coordinated in a non-managed market to begin with, and even among managed care plans, it's very, very difficult. But the point is that this is not required. Medicare beneficiaries who choose from, what did you say, 50% have six or more private fee-for-service plans to choose from, have not the benefit of having standardized Medigap policies to understand cost-sharing, for example. Any private fee-for-service plan can design its own cost-sharing structure, and Medicare beneficiaries in half of the markets have six or more plans to choose from.
Six or more firms.
Many more packages, perhaps. So the point is, I think it's very important. We are inside the Beltway, so we're allowed to talk about policy. And I think it's very important to examine what the statute permits private fee-for-service plans to do. And one of the things they are not required to do is to manage care.
The other thing I wanted to just
can I just say something?
Yeah.
That's not reality, Joyce. That's not what's happening when an 84-year-old woman in Racine, Wisconsin, has a crisis because her doctor doesn't have time to take care of her. But when you provide, because the marketplace creates the opportunity, and you go in and say, you know what, you need a nurse. And you need a nurse to coordinate those services.
Can we talk about whether this, the marketplace, I mean, just to pick up a couple of things here. I mean, first, there are other plan options that can do the same things that you're talking about. And arguably, or there's some evidence, do it more efficiently. The first thing, and you said market, you know, respond. You made that point, and you just made a point a second ago about the response has been great to this. I mean, given that on average a 19% payment above fee for service and providing the additional benefits, I'm sure the response is really favorable. I think, you know, the question is, and I'm sorry, we are inside the Beltway. I'm not sure I can breathe even outside of it, which is unfortunate for me. But the question is like, as a country, what we're financing here? Because I mean, I think your point is well taken. I mean, if I got additional benefits, I would respond well to that too. The question is what is the most efficient way to deliver that? And as a society, who is paying for it? I think that's the question.
The other thing I wanted to just, if I can jump in with one thing, because we did have a chance to talk to firms delivering private fee for service and MA outside the Beltway last year for ASPE, and I found very different opinions about and strategies among firms offering private fee-for-service. Several of them said, hey, this is just not a managed product, and we're not going to manage it. Others said, we're restricted. We can't do anything with the physicians because the law doesn't allow us to. We may be trying to do something with the patients. There were some firms that were actively going after the parts of it they could, but even those said it's not going to be easy. So I think there's a broad diversity in strategies among companies offering these firms.
I think part of the challenge is that Congress made a very conscious choice to exempt private fee-for-service plans from some of the quality reporting requirements that the HMOs have to comply with. And I think the challenge will be is can policymakers make a smart determination that the payments are kind of worth it for the beneficiaries? And I think that's going to be the fundamental tension with the private fee-for-service plan to kind of bring both points together is, I mean, I'm not sure policymakers will ever know whether or not private fee-for-service plans have better quality outcomes because Congress made a very conscious choice to exempt these plans, which kind of stems back from the philosophical kind of thinking behind these plans.
A couple other points I'd like to make is, yes, there is confusion among beneficiaries at the beginning, but clearly you never introduce anything of this kind of magnitude and change where you don't go through some period of confusion, where it takes time for providers, health plans, beneficiaries, families, everyone to get up to speed. So I don't think that we should find that particularly unusual or just the fact that there is some confusion a reason why we should stop that. The second thing is, and I think the point was just made, yes, there is, Congress did make a point to offer choice, and there is a benefit in choice. There are many people who value choice above many other pieces. I'm certainly not going to get into an argument with Mark over the calculation of the 112%, but I think all of you or many of you are probably aware that there are reports that are out there that saying maybe that wasn't an apples-to-apples comparison. in particular the fact that the Deficit Reduction Act had already reduced some of the funding, and that perhaps there needs to be a relook at some of those numbers to make sure that that really is the correct comparison. The other point I would make is that there needs to be incentive in order to get plans to move into this, bringing up programs like care management programs, albeit that it may be voluntary. Plans are interested in doing that. Beneficiaries love Medicare payments, but when it comes to engaging in care management, we find that they truly trust the Blue Cross brand to help bring them that kind of support that they need and that their families need in order to bring those programs together. And we're all in favor of driving to lower cost and better quality. No one objects to that. We all understand that that's the way it's going to move. We're all ready to make those steps, but it needs to be gradual because the investment and the time and the education and all the other factors that have been brought up need to march us where we need to go.
I got to respond on the 112%. No, but I'm willing to. I'm just kidding about the argument part, but I am going to rebut it. I mean, we've been through this. We've put these numbers out for several years now. There are a set of criticisms that the AHIP has put together. We talk to the AHIP analysts every time we do this, and we go through it. And I can, you know, in excruciating detail, go through each of those if you would like, but I won't. What I will say is what I find interesting about these comments are that nobody ever ends the sentence with saying, well, then what is your number? And what I'm willing to say is that even if I stipulated, and I want to be clear that I'm not accepting those arguments, but if I did, I don't believe that those adjustments to the numbers would change the argument. It might bring it to 108% or some number like that, and that's if I were being generous. The point about the budget neutrality, we have included that in the numbers, and I can go through some of the other mechanical differences. But the point is it wouldn't fundamentally change the underlying argument, which is that they're still being paid well above fee for service. Oh, one other thing. There was another comment, and I hope I didn't misinterpret this, but you said you need to incent the plan to move into these areas, I think. And if that was your point, the concern here is that if you put this money out on the table, you incent the plan, you give the beneficiary a very generous package, what dynamic do we think is going to occur that's ever going to remove that incentive? There's no incentive for the plan to be efficient, and certainly the beneficiary is not going to want to give any of this up. And so some of our concern is if you take that type of approach, put a large block of dollars on the stump inside Washington, it's very hard to come back off of that. And we just think fundamentally providers, hospitals, physicians, managed care plans, whoever they are, have no incentive to innovate and be efficient if their payments aren't under some deal of some degree of fiscal pressure.
And Joyce, isn't there also an issue of equity within the Medicare program itself for the beneficiaries in terms of those who may not elect to go this way?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, Medicare entitles beneficiaries to a benefit package. That brings to mind the issue around why there was such pressure around the time of the BBA to have private plans in rural counties particularly. And that had to do with the drug benefit. Most beneficiary who lived in those rural counties didn't have access to prescription drug coverage, and they were desperate to have it. And I think that there were those who thought that if we brought in the HMOs that were demonstrating that they could offer drug benefits elsewhere, that maybe the people in the rural areas would get it too. Well, we have Part D now, and the benefits for preventive services have been improved in the traditional program so that all beneficiaries are entitled to those services. And now the additional benefits that you see come in the form of reduced cost sharing, reduction in premiums, some dental and some vision benefits. But the bulk of the really important benefits have been addressed with the traditional program. So the issue of having to have private plans, even though they cost the Medicare program considerably more, has to be rethought. The issue of what the entitlement is and whether in every part of the country a private plan as part of the entitlement has to be considered in light of the challenges that the program faces with respect to its financial well-being. So I think we have to have a better understanding why there is justification for paying plans above what we pay for the traditional program, which everybody has always assumed was going to be the top in terms of how expensive a plan was. And in the old days, remember, we thought the efficiency factor, the 95% of the AAPCC, was that which should determine whether the private plans participate. And we've moved away from that. Now we're at 100%. But it seems to me that that's really where we should draw the line with respect to payment.
Can I add something? First of all, what I'm very intrigued about in this discussion is that the plans that the growth is, a lot of the growth has been in rural areas. As you just said before, Mark, that not just focusing on plans, but focusing on providers, focusing on the whole delivery system. As we all know, rural providers, rural and plans seem to get a bump in payment from the federal programs because of rural set-asides, because of critical access hospitals, because of a lot of factors. Fair? The point being that, in fact, if it costs more money in rural areas to provide services and the government is part of the reason why it costs more money because they get paid more, then it's kind of logical that as people provide health plan services in those communities, one might think that it costs more to do that, and that's kind of a factor. But that's not what I'm trying to argue. I'm just kind of laying out that as an additional issue. Just to, okay, you can. Absolutely, you can come back. But let me give you a little reality, too, outside of the Beltway, because I kind of live within and without it, so I'm a little kind of a little schizophrenic in that way, that I can play within and I can play without. So now I'd like to play without for a moment. Let me tell you a little about where our enrollments have come so you get a sense of this in the real world. They're not the urban centers that we know, but they're the Greensboro, North Carolina, the Syracuse, New York, the Green Bay, Wisconsin, the York, Pennsylvania, the Spotsylvania, Virginia. Those kind of markets have attracted these kind of cities and communities have the response to Medicare beneficiaries has been very strong to these type of plans. And the factors, again, are threefold: the care management aspect, the higher benefits, and the lower cost seem to be the reasons why people are moving in this direction. I think what you also need to take into consideration is the genius of American capitalism. And I think that as the market works and people become more sophisticated, Joyce, yeah, it's an early stage of this program. But as the program evolves, much like 30 years ago when we were doing HMOs for the first time, the market is in an evolution. Private fee-for-service is in its infancy, and it's one step that got more people involved in the Medicare Advantage concept and managed care principles than we've had in a long, long time. I think that's brilliant. I think the next step of this is the next iterations will be companies will learn to be efficient in the delivery of the services by organizing them, by working with providers, by creating care management strategies and techniques, by beneficiary acceptance, by beneficiaries demanding and us responding. I think that's all part of where we are. And it's a time when the public and the private sectors need to intersect and collaborate and come up with solutions that are going to be good for everybody. So we're all in favor of that.
I mean, I think one of the things that we haven't talked about yet is how private fee-for-service plans are kind of marketing themselves to beneficiaries. And I think one concern we heard with producing this paper for the Kaiser Family Foundation is that the private fee-for-service plan has the connotation of that is similar to traditional fee-for-service. You can see any doctor in the system. You can see any hospital that's in the system. But according to the kind of private plan law, there's no requirement that a physician has to see a private fee-for-service beneficiary. And I think beyond just the payment questions that are being discussed, I think it's another question of I mean, do beneficiaries really perceive that they do beneficiaries really have access to every Medicare doctor, every Medicare hospital, given that the kind of there is no network and there isn't a requirement for a doctor to take a health plan beneficiary, be it private fee for service or be it a network HMO.
I would make a couple of comments along those lines because we have the unique experience of being both significantly in the individual but also even more so into the group market. And the way we look at it is the individual has the choice, and we recommend to them, you know, to say, check with your doctor and make sure that they're going to participate in this program so that you don't have disruption to care. On the other hand, when the employer does a full replacement and the member does not have a choice, I mean, the member has a choice. Generally, the way the employers work it is you can choose not to move into this, but if you do, then you lose your employer-paid coverage. So that's certainly a great deal of incentive. And the way we have approached it is we've set up phone lines, you know, we've had them in place since the first of the year for the public school retirees. If a member says my provider won't see me or this hospital or whatever, we make an outreach to the provider, make sure that it's not an education issue or simply a confusion issue. And then if they need an alternative provider, we help them identify what their other options are in order to get care. So it's certainly the provider does continue to have that option, and I think the plans who are in this have made at least certain, all I can speak for is ours, but you know, we have market presence, we have a dominance because we have an excellent relationship and reputation for taking care of our members. We have many people who have had Blue Cross coverage, you know, from cradle to grave, and we've done that because we've taken care of our members.
Diane, could I just say one thing before we leave the provider piece? I think this is really important because a lot of people don't understand this. We as an industry initially went to CMS and asked for assistance on the deeming process because it was very confusing to a lot of providers, and a lot of the first innovators in this area had a lot of problems and it caused a lot of confusion. What a lot of the second lead folks did, the second companies that got into this, was bring provider relations to the communities prospectively before they had plans so they could educate physicians and hospitals about the terms and conditions of participating as a deemed provider and what it meant. Thank you.
There's also just one quick thing. There's also a CMS website where a provider can hook in and find out what kind of coverage does this member have. And there has been a glitch in the system in that it was originally established for Medicare Plus Choice, at which time they were all HMO, so a provider can put a member's name in and or their HIC number and find out. It'll come up and say HMO, where in fact the member may have private fee for service. And now we have, you know, of the promise that this is going to be fixed very soon, but it has caused some confusion that we have had to overcome.
Mark.
I have some comments, but if you want to stay on the marketing point, they're not related to that.
Well, I'd like to have your comments, and then we're going to open it up to the audience to ask their questions because I think they've been very patient listening to us go back and forth at the front of the room.
All right. So I'll make this quick. I want to be clear that there are some things that Gary said in his last sets of comments that I think we do strongly agree with, and they are the following things. You know, collaboration between the public and private sector in order to bring, you know, greater coordination, information, efficiency to the system, something the commission has said time and time again. My concern is, and with the last set of comments, though, is we need to be really clear here. This is not a competitive system, really. They do bid against the benchmarks. But the benchmarks are really administratively set. They're sort of artifacts from the old payment system. And so my concern is Gary's point is that over time, the plans will become more efficient and become more coordinated. The concern, I think, a different way to express the commission's concern is not with these types of payment systems because they aren't really driving competition or a drive towards efficiency. On the rural area point and on it's sort of this general point on extra benefits, I mean, again, I think the commission's posture on this would be, if we want that, if we want to pay differently in a rural area, or we want to provide a particular benefit for a beneficiary, a low-income beneficiary, whatever the case may be, the issue then becomes more of a definition and targeting issue. How do we go at it in order to assure that that is what we're actually achieving, as opposed to this arrangement where you have these five different plan types, very different approaches, very different payments, and in some instances, as John was saying, an inability to determine what the impact of all of that is.
So we're clearly seeing that there are equity issues, there are payment issues, level of coverage issues, and really where are we driving the overall Medicare program with these plan choices that are out there. But now it's your opportunity to pose questions to our panelists, and to do so, please stand up, raise your hand, and identify yourself when you pose your question.
Hi, my name is Allie Bonebrake. I'm with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. It's my understanding that all Medicare beneficiaries subsidize these higher payments to Medicare Advantage plans by paying higher Part B premiums. I was wondering, as enrollment rises in Medicare Advantage plans, what's going to happen to the beneficiaries who remain in traditional Medicare? Thank you.
Well, certainly, to the first half of your question, it is true that the additional cost, the average 12% above fee for service, does end up getting reflected in the premium. And I think it's, you know, we've been messing around with numbers a little bit on this, and I think it's on the order of about $2 per month that a beneficiary pays on that front. So. It definitely does get reflected in the Part B premium.
The only thing I would add is that it's very important that the traditional program remain viable. It's still the coverage option that is most popular. It's My Medicare. Everybody knows how important and how highly valued the Medicare program is to beneficiaries, and we need to be sure that we protect it, and that we strengthen it, and that we improve it. But we certainly don't want to see it in any way detrimentally affected by these types of payments.
By the way, I would agree 100% with that comment.
Hi, I'm Vicki Gottlisch at the Center for Medicare Advocacy. And I have a question about demographics. We know Catherine's group represents retirees. They're probably wealthier. They're over 65. Gary says that he markets to seniors. What about younger people with disabilities? What about poorer people? Do we have any idea yet of who's enrolling in these plans? We hear a lot of marketing to dual eligibles who get no benefits from these plans at all. So I was wondering if either Marcia or John has any sense yet of what the enrollment is like.
I mean, Marcia may know better than I, but I don't think we really know the complete demographic composition to the average beneficiary signing up into a private fee-for-service plan. We've heard anecdotally that they are being more heavily marketed, I think Gary said, to parts of the country that are kind of the small urban, kind of the kind of rural areas that have the higher payment levels relative to fee-for-service due to the historical floors. Some of the benefit packages, when you compare them to traditional fee-for-service, tend to have sometimes higher cost sharing for post-acute care services, which may suggest that a beneficiary that needs post-acute care could end up paying more in a private fee-for-service plan than in a traditional benefit. And it kind of bounces all over the map. There's not a real hard and fast rule. But I think those kinds of patterns kind of give some indication that there is a different demographic mix to private fee-for-service plans. What's very interesting to me is when you look at the kind of change in overall private plan beneficiary counts since 2004, that just about most of the new beneficiaries going into private fee-for-service plans have total plans have chosen private fee-for-service plans. So it seems to be a very strong tendency for new beneficiaries coming into the MA program are choosing private fee-for-service plans. That could be that the kind of HMO marketplace is somewhat saturated. That could be different marketing tactics to different beneficiary, you know, kind of demographics. But what's really fascinating to me is that what's happening since 2004 is that a very high proportion of new enrollees to the MA program are going into private fee-for-service plans, which may counter, depending on your viewpoint, Congress's intent to expand managed care. This, I mean, I think that the new growth to MA is, you know, more open network than some in Congress may have wanted.
I just want to add the observation that for we've been focusing, I think, on the aged, those people who are over 65, but it may very well be that the private fee-for-service option may be of benefit to people who are disabled, particularly when they can't pick up a Medigap policy. We don't see a whole lot of focused marketing to this disabled population, but that might indeed be a population that would benefit, because in the traditional program it might be difficult for the disabled population to pick up a Medigap policy. So it is one area where it clearly may advantage a disabled Medicare beneficiary to pick up the coverage that is typically provided through a Medigap policy.
I just want to be sure everyone is clear that whether a plan is an HMO or a PPO or a private fee for service, we are all paid the same amount for any one given county. It is not that it's paid different. Now, the fact that there are in a number of counties only a private fee-for-service plan, that's another situation. So, yes, in many of these rural counties, some of the demographics are such that these are not your real wealthy seniors or you're not your real wealthy disabled. And, yes, this is the first opportunity that they've had to join these kinds of plans. So, and as far as the retiree group, as I indicated, although we call them the teachers, it's all the public school employees. So you've got your bus drivers, your cafeteria workers, and many of them are not the same image of this wealthy senior that is sometimes perceived. We do have a number of dual eligibles that have signed up for the plan, although I can't give you the exact statistic.
Why would a dual eligible sign up for a private fee-for-service plan?
I'm still trying to answer that question myself.
I think that may make my point.
I have a point to make. Most of our beneficiaries are people that have household incomes of below $30,000. And when you kind of look at their demographic and you look at $30,000 and you look at the context of options open to them in many rural parts of the country, there are not a lot of options. And what private fee-for-service brought to these people were additional options beyond what they could get, which was either standard Medicare benefits the way they exist today, or a Medigap policy. Not that those are bad, because I believe in choice, and I believe in each one of those products and each one of those choices Benny should make. But the idea that private fee-for-service came to the communities, the number one reason people chose them in those communities, because they've gotten additional benefits and it was a lower cost. So if you're a family that's got $30,000 in income and you're spending $5,000 on Medigap policies, it's an awful lot of your family income. So now you have at least the ability to make another choice that you didn't have before. Just kind of throwing it
but
out
the
there.
Value of that choice is going to depend on how much health care you think you'll need, because the financial protection of private fee-for-service compared to the standard Medigap is much less. And so if you add up, I mean, some people may do it because they don't want to pay the higher premiums or can each month. But financially, you're going to be better off with a Medigap if you have high costs than you are with most private fee-for-service.
Martha, I would have bought that, but here's the challenge. If you have a maximum out-of-pocket of $2,500 or $3,000, it tends to kind of parallel what the cost up front would be of a Medigap policy.
On that, and I realize
that Vicki's question has generated quite a debate.
This is all related. It's just, and I think your point is well taken, but it goes back to another point, is if you want to provide that kind of a benefit as part of the Medicare program, is this the most, you know, is this the best way to target it and pay for it? That's the question, because no plan has to do those things, and how they're approaching these things varies considerably. And as I've said, across the plans, there are differences in their level of efficiency.
Sorry.
Okay, next question.
My name is Al Soker. I'm Vice President of Marketing for Old Surety Life Insurance. We're a Midwest carrier, deal primarily in the senior market. I have a couple of questions. You know, we deal with field issues out in the field, the individual. Joyce has talked about the individual. We get calls every day from seniors on Medicare that are struggling to either get in or out of a plan because either they were misled by marketing or were in a situation where CMS has them involved, enrolled in another plan. The other plan won't allow them to get in. There's a lot of problem with seniors, their premiums coming out of their Social Security check and getting put back in. So the financing administration part of it is not being run well at all as far as with CMS and working between the companies. The seniors are in the middle of this complicated system that they can't understand, how do I get out of this? Now, we deal with the field out there, so what's CMS, if anyone can help answer, that's what's being done to help that being taken care of between the companies and CMS. And the second question is, a lot of people may tend to enroll in fee-for-service because of marketing practice. These agents are motivated by commissions. They get a lot of commissions paid to do that, and I see it all the time coming through agents. We have about 600 agents in Texas that are all being wined and dined by the Medicare Advantage companies to offer these plans to these seniors. A lot of them are being misled. Now, there's not much policing going on that either. In fact, I know a lot of major companies are buying Medicare supplement blocks of business to try to switch that business to private fee-for-service or Medicare Advantage plans because there is a lot of dollars dealt with that the companies can make. So the marketing end of it and the administration end of it is not being handled well. We're talking about the big picture here, but get it down on the street level, what the individuals are dealing with.
I can't speak to the CMS issues. I will say that, you know, we do hear those kind of things. I get calls from people because they've heard, you hear anecdotal reports of whether this marketing practice has happened or that marketing practice. And one of the things that frustrates me is that I don't think there's a good way nationally to capture data to actually be able to talk about that. So you do have these anecdotes. I think most people would agree that those things shouldn't happen. Whatever your feeling on this is, that's not something that should happen. I personally think it's actually a black eye for the industry if it happens, because those kind of things, we have a history with them. And I am very concerned that we don't have a good way to sort of systematically know whether they're happening and make sure they don't.
I mean, I think one thing we have heard, you know, through anecdotes is there are different commissions being paid to insurance brokers for different products, be it PDP, private fee-for-service, HMO. And I think that does have some implications how these plans are being marketed to beneficiaries, and that there could be some incentives to promote some kinds of plans more than others, which could explain some of the growth that we've seen right now.
As
Tom Miller, American Enterprise Institute. Mark's very persuasive in terms of the differentials on the payments going to the plans. I'd like to kind of get some answers, though, to the payments going to the providers. It's hinted at a little bit in John's work, but it's not clear. Correct me if I'm wrong. There was older law which said basically if you went out of network in Medicare, that you paid the Medicare rates. Now, the argument in MMA was that the providers would not play ball with PPOs or networks in some of these rural areas. But private fee-for-service is allowed to basically use the Medicare-administered fees to pay the doctors and the hospitals. So is there any variation? Are any of these fee-for-service plans paying the providers anything more than the bare minimum while getting the highest reimbursement rates? And is there any sign of providers not playing ball with the private fee-for-service plans where you don't really need a network contract, you just basically get the benefit of the administered rates?
Thanks, Tom, for the question. What the rules say with private fee-for-service is that if a plan decides not to have a network, they have to pay at least fee-for-service rates. So they get from CMS the DRG payment systems, the physician fee schedules, and they pretty much pay the same calibrated rates that's paid for traditional fee-for-service plans. If you don't know, you know, how payments differ precisely for, you know, doctor to doctor, but we do know that, the majority of private fee-for-service plans have chosen not to set up networks, which means they are paying at least the same traditional fee-for-service DRG payment rates. But I mean, I think, Tom, you are right that, you know, there were some concerns back in 2003 about private plans not being able to set up networks in the rural areas, but I think the trend we're seeing is that most private fee-for-service plans that are in the rural areas aren't setting up networks. They're paying traditional fee-for-service the same DRG payment rates, which, you know, kind of gets to the question we've been talking about relative payment rates for the plan types.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's also been my sense when I talk to plans. They're basically paying Medicare's rates. They had the option. We thought they might pay more. We thought they might make beneficiaries pay more. They're allowed to do 115%, but they're paying those. And there are some concerns. I think we don't know yet whether the physicians are playing along with this. There was a report out in California of problems in some of the markets there with whether physicians are playing. In previous years, there have been some questions as to whether physicians know it. This, like the commission issue, is one that I wish there was a better way to get a handle on so we knew what's happening, because I think that's a disaster if you hear stories of beneficiaries signing up for Medicare benefits when they think they can have access to all doctors and then they try and get care and they can't find it. Again, I don't think that's to anyone's advantage.
Let me just comment on the administrative issues. I think, you know, they're certainly very real. Some of the coordination between CMS and Social Security have been, you know, well known. But it's not a case where it applies to only the Medicare Advantage. Those same issues have gone across the PDP. And so I think we would have them no matter what. And there clearly are issues.
Hi, my name is Colette Desmaris. I work for Senator Grassley on the Finance Committee. This question is to Kathy and Gary, and it sort of follows on the points about the networks. Both of you have mentioned that you do care management or you offer care management services. I'm wondering, to what extent do you have a contracted network and to what extent you rely on deeming, because you both mentioned deeming, so I'm feeling that you rely on it to a certain extent. And how do you have deemed providers who don't have a relationship with you and who, it's my understanding, can change that relationship even if they deem one time, a beneficiary can go to that same provider 4 months later and the provider chooses not to accept your terms and conditions. How do you do care management in that type of situation? And as a follow-on, if we have any information on the extent to which plans are network, private fee-for-service, or non-network? I didn't think so. Okay, thanks.
Sorry. Thank you for the question. The first response is this is a patient-centric care management model. It's the only way that it can work when you do not have providers that have agreed to strategic relationships or strategic alliances with a plan. So it's really patient-centric, which means that there are several points of identification, whether it's through a health risk appraisal, whether it's through pharmacy claims, whether it's through medical claims, whether it's through DME, whether it's through an indication through a chronic illness, that you make contact with the individual, you educate them through your nurses directly about the program options available to them, and then you stratify them based on their risk and put them into a very specific program with nurses in the field, in the market, working with them. So that's kind of the approach we took. The deeming issue is challenging, but let me tell you where I think this may be going. In concentrations of populations, there may be now opportunities, and again, I think this is the genius of the creation of MMA and the entrepreneurial kind of mode that it's set to create a playing field of competition. If you want doctors to work with you, then you've got to come up with strategies that align the interests of the doctor with the beneficiary and with the plan. So if you're not paying doctors timely and they choose not to participate in your plan, then probably what the market is saying is figure out a way to pay them more timely, more engage them in the process, let them want to be deemed into your system because you are a good system. So I think those are all part of the solution to what you're raising. It's a complex issue in a lot of rural areas. Initially, a lot of hospitals would say no. And you know who really came to bat most of the time? It was the doctors, because they have the sacred relationship with their individual patients. And they take that relationship pretty strongly in rural America. And when the hospital says no, they can go back to the hospital and say, you know what, we're doing it. We'd like you to do it. And we have found pretty much that most providers have been accepting once they've been educated and once became part of the process.
A couple of other points. We find that if a person carries a blue card, the facilities, the physicians, think of the person as a blue member. And so although our programs are voluntary, we find that the providers basically treat the members very much the same way. So they will call in pre-certification or pre-notification, even though it is voluntary. So we certainly have that advantage. The other thing we're able to do is a lot of data mining, where we can take the claims from all the services, including prescription drugs, including DME or whatever, and not only what the patient needs today, but also do disease management for where we think that member's going, which goes back to one of the other points that was made earlier, saying, well, now that we've got PDP in throughout the country, maybe we don't need MA as much. But I would say that in order to really do care management, it's important that, or we certainly get a better outcome if we're able to have the full package and be able to manage not only the medical therapies but the drug therapies at the same time.
I think we have a debate here that we'll just keep going with the next question.
Hi, Rolf Rosenkranz with Inside CMS. I have two questions. One for the critics of private fee-for-service. I'm wondering, trying to understand how big your qualms really are with the program. Let's say private fee-for-service plans were required to manage care similar to the other managed care plans, and let's say the payments were reduced. Would you be all right with the survival of private fee-for-service? And then I have another question.
It seems to me we would call it something else, like maybe a PPO. I mean, it's not as though there are not other models in the Medicare program. And Congress was very explicit about what the requirements were and what they weren't. There are many models. PPOs are a broader coverage option than a traditional HMO, for example. So it's not as though that is not already in place. You can make anything look like anything, but at the moment we have requirements and we have statutory authority for an entity called a private fee-for-service plan, which is allowed to do certain things, and they are allowed to present themselves to Medicare beneficiary in a particular way. That there is diversity complicates the problem enormously, because Medicare beneficiaries have a great deal of difficulty in making the distinctions about the choices, which is why I made the point initially about the need for genuine choice. It's hard to imagine why anybody would need a choice of 6 fee-for-service plans. I mean, it's just, I don't understand what rational person would organize healthcare around having 6 choices for fee-for-service when it's the same doctors. So all that you have is the opportunity for mass confusion with different cost sharing. I want to bring a point about Medicare beneficiaries with respect to that. It means that Medicare beneficiaries have to be exquisitely skilled with respect to decision making. That means that they have to have high health literacy skills. They have to be extremely numerate. And we know that as people age, those skills decline. And, you know, Gary, before you painted a very rosy picture about what it would be like once people get used to these new options. But when people age, their skills change. Their confidence in their own decision-making changes. We have very good evidence around health literacy, for example. And we know that as people age, that skill declines. We also have evidence that is very sobering, that people who have less honed skills, whose decision-making skills are not as good, tend to ask for help less often. We've published and the ARP Public Policy Institute, several studies that Judy Hibbard did for us to look at the relationship between patient activation and health literacy. So I think we really have to be careful about what we're talking about. You can modify anything. You can call an elephant a tiger. But the point is, what is there and what is required of somebody to understand it and to make an informed choice?
I think that part of your question is sort of getting to the fact of, you know, should Congress change this program, or should it change the payment level? Should it change the requirements? Should it change, you know, different benefit rules to be more consistent to an HMO or PPO type product? I think I want to bring the discussion back to my earlier comments that this program really wasn't created just to provide choice, but it had a very strong constituency, the right to life interest, that wanted to, you know, kind of have a very open option plan. And I think if Congress were to change the program to be more similar to a kind of PPO type product, that you would hear the same concerns coming back. And I think that would, you know, cause, you know, some to question, you know, should this program be changed?
Hi, I'm Paul Precht with the Medicare Rights Center. Just on that last point, I'm wondering if the Right to Life constituency that was in favor of this would be happy with plans that don't have an out-of-pocket limit. So if you're talking about expensive end-of-life care, it's really a financial choice. And some of these plans also require prior authorization for extended hospital stays. So it doesn't seem to have even met the criteria that it was supposed to. But my basic question is this. For $65 billion, could the Medicare program have an out-of-pocket limit for everybody and have care coordination for everybody with chronic disease? I mean, I know you all aren't.
Fortunately, everyone's looking at me. And I don't know. I certainly, and I'm not making light of your question at all. I mean, I certainly understand what you're saying. And I think what you're saying is, and it goes back to something that I've said earlier. I really honestly don't know the answer of what would it cost to do that type of thing. But I think what you're driving at is, if we want, you know, a subsidy for low-income beneficiaries, if we want catastrophic caps or whatever the case may be, what is the correct way to target, you know, determine eligibility and spend out for that? And I think if we were asked that question, the way the commission would proceed through analyzing that problem would be to ask those questions and then try and arrive at a solution. I mean, there are examples in Medicare where there are low-income subsidies, for example, or benefit supports that are targeted to specific population, the low-income subsidy and the drug benefit. That is the way. I mean, part of what I'm trying to say here is that if that's what this is about, you know, a different benefit, a richer benefit, we should be thinking about the problem that way, rather than the way it seems to be occurring, sort of, you know, how it happens to evolve across the plans, where they locate, what services they offer. I'm sorry, I don't know the direct answer to the $65 billion question, but I do. I think I see what you're trying to say.
Hi, I'm Stuart Gutterman with the Commonwealth Fund, and on that $65 billion question, I just like to add a comment that you really need to look at it on a per beneficiary basis, because the extra spending for Medicare Advantage only applies to now 18% of the population. You're talking about 82% of the population, so you need to look at it that way. But what I'd like to do, it seems like a lot of talk here is geared around whether the market works, and it seems to me that there's a lot of information we don't have about not only special the private fee-for-service plans, but also special needs plans and Medicare Advantage and, in fact, Part D. And I'd like to call on CMS to sort of make more information available so that we can look into some of these issues. You know, people talk about transparency. One of the key tenets of a market functioning properly is the availability of information. And it seems to me like a lot of people in this town talk about transparency as putting a black box into a Lucite box. So that doesn't quite get at it. And it would also be to the benefit of the good plans, because there are good plans undoubtedly in these programs, and it helps us distinguish between the good plans who do what we'd like to see being done for beneficiaries and the bad plans who just take advantage of the financial incentives and walk away from the program. So,
well, on that note, I hope that we have helped to put something other than a black box inside of the Lucite box that we're talking about today. But I think we've had a very lively discussion. I know you have a lot of questions. I think this is the beginning of a series of examinations we'd like to do on the evolving nature of the Medicare program. And I want to thank all of our panelists for their many comments and for their lively dialogue with us today, and you for coming. Thank you.
Thank you.